The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words. And those taking part are Nancy Spain, Dillis Powell, Dennis Norton, and Frank Muir. Here's round one to test their vocabulary. 2 marks if they get the meanings of these words right. Nancy Spain, the meaning of the word hydromel, H-Y-D-R-O-M-E-L, hydromel.
Oh, I came on a recipe for this the other day.
Very good.
In my grandmother Spain's rough notebook. It's a it's a mixture of honey and lemon juice and water and is very, very good for the cough.
Quite right. 2 marks. Frank Muir, the meaning of the word ultimogeniture, U-L-T-I-M-O-G-E-N-I-T-U-R-E.
Ultimo means last.
Yes.
Gen is information. Which, it's the late news summary.
No, it's a rather particular kind of gen. I think your partner would help you.
Birth? That's
with an I.
Geniture.
Yes, that's more like it.
Ultimogeniture, the last birth.
Yes, now we're getting nearer.
Ah. Am I near enough?
No. I'll give you a half mark. It's the system in which the youngest or last son takes the property or inheritance, as opposed to primogeniture, which is the usual thing, where the eldest son inherits everything. Dennis Powell, the meaning of the word nidification, N-I-D-I-F-I-C-A-T-I-O-N, nidification.
Well, Jack, economic progress.
Yes, it is economic progress, because when my husband and I were furnishing a house,
mm-hmm.
and I would go out to work, you know, to earn the rent, I used to come back with a waste paper basket or, you know, waste paper basket or an old knife without a handle.
That's right, yeah.
And my husband used to say I was nesting.
That's absolutely right. Yeah.
In fact, I was making a nest. I was indulging in nidification.
Quite right. 2 marks. It's the building of nests from a Latin word. Dennis Norton. This is a bit tough, too.
I am not afraid.
What is an opsimath?
Opsimath. Oh, yes. Yes. I've got it. I don't want it, but... opsi... Well, math is easy. That's from sums. Opsi is when a child falls down on the ground. It's generally combined with the word daisy to form the word opsy-daisy. Now, if a child falls down on his arithmetic, then you would say opsy-math.
Yes, you would. You would. But you better define it in some other word, otherwise I can't help you very much.
I can't help myself very much with this one, Jack.
I think 1 out of 2, you've got the main idea behind it. It's a late developer. It's one who learns late in life, and it comes from the Greek.
Oh.
Well, before we start round 2, I give each team a quotation for them to write down, and the 2 women members of the team then study their quotations throughout the program, and at the end, I shall ask them where those quotations come from. Nancy Spain and Dennis Norton, your quotation is, "In the great right of an excessive wrong." And Dillis Power with Frank Muir, your quotation is, "I'm going to wash that man right out of my hair." A rather clue there, wasn't it? And then at the end of the program, I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their ideas of how these words came to be said or written, and I don't want any of these answers yet. So to round 2. I want to know how well you know your Gulliver's Travels by Swift. And during his travels, Lemuel Gulliver met a number of strange creatures, some of them human in shape and some of them not. For 2 marks, who or what were the following? Nancy Spain, who was Glumdalclitch?
Oh, my heavens. I'm sure he was a giant. He was one of the big ones in Bromdignag.
It was that...
Wrong sex.
Objectionable little girl.
Oh, yes, she picked him up in the marrowbone or something and squeezed him.
Now, that was
him.
A dwarf. But, no, enough. The dwarf was nasty and stuffed him into a marrowbone.
But Grumdilnet, your friend.
was my friend Glumdale Pitch, yes.
Grumdale.
I think you're near enough. I think two marks.
Thank you, Dennis North.
She was a young girl, but she was very small for her age. She was not above 40 feet high, being little for her age. You see, this was the country of the giants, and she wasn't a very big one. And she was nurse to Gulliver and looked after him when he visited Bromdignag, and it means my little nurse. Frank Muir, who were the big Indians and the little Indians?
A moment to get my bearings. In Lilliput there were two causes of strife. One was internal and one was external. The internal ones were whether you wore big heels or small heels. There was also internal dissension over whether you hit your egg on the big end and the little end.
Yes.
Because they used to hit it on the big end, and the emperor's grandfather, when a boy, hit the big end, and his knife slipped, and he cut his thumb.
Yes.
They were then ordained to all Lilliputians must hit their egg on the little end. But the old diehards wouldn't do this, and they were banished from the kingdom to Blefuscal.
Well done.
And they then had little wars between them, and little forage parties, and little forays, and they consulted the Quran, which said that all believers hit their egg on the convenient end, which they both claimed was the little and big, respectively.
Absolutely wonderful and accurate. And I think Frank deserves a bonus mark for that. I'm going to give him three. And it was, of course, as he suggests, a satire on the feuds between the churches, and with definite reference to the Reformation in England, turning from Catholic to Protestant, and Henry VIII being the sort of catalyst. And the quotation from their Bible, the Blundekral, was all true believers break their eggs at the convenient end. Now, Dillis Powell, who were the Houyhnhnms and the Yahoos? H-O-U-Y-H-N-H-N-M-S and the Yahoos.
Well, the Houyhnhnms were the nice ones.
Yes.
And the Yahoos were the dirty ones.
Yes.
The Houyhnhnms were horses.
They were.
Well, the Yahoos were... Well, they weren't horses.
No.
They were more disagreeable.
What?
What were they?
Nasty people.
Just horrors. Just nasty. Just dirty people. They were very dirty.
Walking on how many legs?
Oh.
I think one and a half, Dillis. This is the last book of Gulliver's Travels. The Houyhnhnms were intelligent and absolutely charming horses, and their simplicity and virtue was contrasted with these beastly creatures, the Yahoos, who were sort of debased human beings, and brutal and vulgar and nasty and dirty. It was Swift's final attack on human beings. One and a half marks. Dennis Norden, who were the Struldbrugs? S-T-R-U-L-D-B-R-U-G-S. Struldbrugs.
I can only remember vaguely that I loved him and hated her.
Something to do with getting sunlight out of cucumber.
Yes, that's the right book.
I'm informed from usually reliable sources that it was something to do with getting sunlight out of cucumber.
There was a flat land like that.
The microphone, would you like to take over?
With a point on the top. And the Struldbrugs, or whatever they were called, were devoted to extracting this weird way of life.
Half a mark for trying very hard. This was the time he visited the land of Laputa, and as Nancy quite rightly says, this was sort of an enormous flying saucer which was up in the air. Yes. And here were people who were the early scientists whom Swift satirized, but among them were to be found these wretched creatures, the Struldbrugs, who were condemned to immortality. And it wasn't much fun for them, because though they went on and on forever, they got more and more stupid and more weak and more frail the longer they went on. So this put a stopper to the idea it was a nice thing to live forever. Well, the next round is verse and poetry. I give each member of the team a quotation and ask them for the following line or lines to complete it. 2 marks if they can go on successfully, and 2 more for naming author and book if they know it. Beginning with Nancy Spain. They love the good, they worship truth, they laugh uproariously in youth.
And when they start to getting old, they up and shoot themselves, I'm told. Rupert Brooke.
Yes.
Grantchester.
Yes, quite right. Well done, Nancy. That's 4 marks. It's Rupert Brooke, the old vicarage, Grantchester. They love the good, they worship truth, they laugh uproariously in youth. And when they get to feeling old, they up and shoot themselves, I'm told. Well done, Nancy. Frank Muir. Kathleen Mavourneen, the grey dawn is breaking.
Kathleen Mavourneen, the grey dawn is breaking. Home is the hunter with horn from the hill. So I better take you home again. It's an Irish song.
We gathered that. Bye.
That Irishman, Onan.
Well, again, difficult to mark it too, I think, for knowing it, the next line more or less, rather less than more, and knowing it was Irish. Kathleen Mavourneen, in The Grey Dawn is Breaking. The horn of the hunter is heard on the hill. The lark from her light wing, the bright dew is shaking. Kathleen Mavourneen, what? Slumbering still. It goes on like that for a very long time. And it's by Julia Crawford. And
oh, she.
Written in 1835 and first appeared in the Metropolitan Magazine, London. Two, I think. Dennis Powell. Here's a health unto His Majesty with a fell la 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 la.
Oh, I know the next line to this.
If you will not drink his health, something or other, you... Something. Come on, Frank.
He didn't do enough la la's.
No. La 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 la. Goes on like that.
La 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 la.
There we are. That's all we need.
That's the next
line. Those who will not drink his health, I wish them neither something nor wealth.
Yes. And who's it by?
Who's it by? Oh dear.
You talked about this before.
Talked about this before.
Frank did.
A nun.
Anon.
All right, I think 3.5 is a fairly generous marking here. It's a song. Here's a health unto His Majesty, a 17th century song, I think. Here's a health unto His Majesty with a fell-la-la-la-la-la, like that. Conversion to his enemies, that's the line you must start. And then a lot more fells and lels and las. And he that will not pledge his health, I wish him neither wit nor wealth, nor yet a rope to hang himself. Oh. With a fell la 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 la. Very difficult.
La.
Right, back to Dennis Norden. Alas, my love, you do me wrong to cast me off discourteously.
Oh, this is another singing one.
Yes?
I'm not going to sing it without my group. Alas, my love, you do me
That's
wrong
right.
to cast me off discourteous. What is it? And it ends Greensleeve.
That's it, yes. All right. By whom?
Was attributed to Henry VIII.
Yes, all right, this is getting better. 3.5 marks. It's probably anonymous, but some people have attributed it to Henry VIII. It's called a new courtly sonnet of the Lady Greensleeves to the new tune of Greensleeves, and it appeared in a book called A Handful of Pleasant Delights in 1584. Next round is the who, where, and what department. For 2 marks, who or what were the following in what work? Nancy Spain, who lived at Thornfield Hall?
Jane Eyre.
Only temporarily. Who really lived there?
Well, Mr. Rochester,
yes, that's
and his
right.
friends.
Yes, 2 marks. Frank Muir, where was Manderley?
Oh, I knew the road very well. The Flying Fishes and the Flotilla. In a book by Daphne du Maurier.
Yes.
It was the house to which Max de Winter brought his anonymous bride.
Yes.
We knew she was Mrs. De Winter, but we never knew her first name. The Mandalay was the great house there by the sea.
Mm. Haunted by?
Haunted by, overshadowed rather, yes, by the memory of the first Mrs. De Winter. What was done in Evely. In the waters which tumbled below the cliff.
All right, two marks. The house dominated by the dead wife, Rebecca, in Daphne du Maurier's novel. Dennis Powell, what was the first novel which introduced Sherlock Holmes?
Not the Sign of Four, A Study in Scarlet.
Well done, yes. How about that? Dennis Norden, who were Edward and Jane Murdstone?
Mr. Murdstone was the original evil stepfather,
yeah,
in David Copperfield.
Quite right.
Jane, obviously, was some relation. Jane was with him, you know. It was always Edward and Jane Murdstone. One didn't sort of pry into what they were to each other. I think we'd best leave it at that.
One and a half. Out of two. Edward Murdstone was, as Dennis rightly says, David Copperfield's stepfather, and Jane was his sister, and they were very unkind and sent David's mother to an early grave, and then saw that David was ill-treated in a school where he was bullied by the headmaster. Now we come to the last round and go back to those two quotations I gave the teams earlier on the programme. For two marks, Nancy Spain, can you give me the origin of your quotation, In the Great Right of an Excessive Wrong?
Something very obscure from Browning.
Yes, it's not the most obscure of the lot, but perhaps the second most obscure. It comes in the middle of that very long poem, The Ring and the Book, In the Great Right of an Excessive Wrong. And now, Dennis Power would have given the origin of your quotation, which is a bit easier, I think. I'm going to wash that man right out of my hair.
It's a song in South Pacific by Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Yes, quite right. Well, now I'm going to ask Dennis and Frank to give me their explanation of how these quotations came into being. And on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever unlikely explanation receives the longer and larger amount of applause from the audience here in the studio. So back to Dennis Norden and his quotation, In the Great Right of an Excessive Wrong.
This phrase last occurred to me during a period of my life when I was running a matrimonial agency. And at the time in question, we were having our January sale. We were, I think, the only matrimonial agency that did have a sale three times a year, in which we endeavoured to get rid of what we called our remnants. These were ladies and gentlemen that no other ladies and gentlemen particularly fancied, and we used to let them go at cut price. And at this time we had cleared our books except for these two, one man and one lady. And the man was 5'1" and very skinny. His name was Jack Longland. No relation at all. It's just one of those happy coincidences. And the lady was quite different. Her name was Emma Williamson. She was 6'8", and she weighed 16 stone. Now, I had a wild idea how we could close our books for this year, and that was to pair these two off. Now, this was the strange part. She fell for him immediately, like a ton of bricks. And on his side, love took a little longer to blossom. He used to take her out a lot. He saw a lot of her. Well, there was a lot of her to see, you see. And eventually the chemistry happened. Jack came to me one day and he said, well, I never thought I would, but I have. I have fallen in love with this mountain of womanhood. He said, I love her, I want to marry her, but our love can never be anything more than a meeting of minds because of this disparity in our stature. And then I had the sort of thought which justify the place of matrimonial agencies in our economy. I said, you see that chandelier up there? I said, we clean that once a week. Do you know what with? A small folding ladder. I said, it's yours. I said, take the ladder away, Jack. Take it to her apartment, go in her drawing room, climb up it, propose, and then if she accepts you, then you may seal the acceptance in the only way an acceptance can be sealed. He said, but I can't just... It's so embarrassing. He said, I can't take a ladder into a lady's drawing room. What do I say if she says, why are you climbing up that ladder? Tell her, because it's there. Which he did, and he went away, and that was where the tragedy came. That was where the phrase, in the great right of an excessive wrong, sprang to my mind. Because not 2 hours after he'd left, I received a phone call from Emma. She was distraught, hysterical. She said, quick, come where my love lies bleeding. So I made my way to her house, and there in the drawing room, in the fireplace, lay poor little Jack Longland, limp and broken. I saw immediately what had happened. I took the ladder and I placed it against Emma. The ladder was too high. It had one rung too many. And you see what had happened? In his joyous haste, he'd rushed up the ladder, shot clean over her head, and landed in the fireplace. There he lay, where he had fallen, in the grate, right off an excessive rung.
Well, as that story was clearly actionable, I shan't comment on it until I've consulted my solicitor. We'll pass on to Frank Muir, and your quotation, Frank, was, I'm going to wash that man right out of my hair.
I must ask you to forgive me if my voice seems a little white with excitement, but in half an hour's time, the Royal Albert Hall, I'm going to realize a lifelong ambition. I'm going to present to the world an entirely new form of artistic expression. This has always been my dream, and at last I've achieved it. I've always tried to do this. I'm what's called a compulsive innovationist. We might say a constructive iconoclast. Or to use the psychiatric word, a nut. Ever since I was quite young, I've invented things and tried to introduce new things. All the latest musical thing was this reading beat poetry to cool jazz. I thought, this is so old hat. You know, it's time for something really new and breakaway. So I mounted a concert where I read a Board of Trade report to the London Philharmonic Orchestra. This, unfortunately, wasn't a success. I should have foreseen this, of course, because nobody could hear me. I was drowned out by the oxygen. And whilst still on the subject of music, I had my great inspiration, what I could give to the world. Song. Now, think of a song. What is a song? A song is words which are sung. What? You may ha-ha, and I trust you will continue to do so for the next 2 minutes. My breakthrough was music which is spoken. Impossible, you say, this is communism, but it is possible. I have written a tune. I call it Air on a Larynx. It isn't sung, it's spoken. It's spoken by a man. It's quite simple. I'll give you, if I can remember, I'll give you just the opening. A flat. A B-E-D. B-sharp major. E. And so it goes on. For an hour and 20 minutes. Spoken music, a breakthrough. Of course, they all laughed at me. They all said, this can't be. We can't have this. They upraised the twin fingers of scorn. They said... But I've defeated them. I've hired the Albert Hall for tonight. And I've hired an actor called George Wright or Basil Wright or some Wright or other. He's doing it for 30 bob and a trip home to Pinner afterwards. And he's learnt my air tonight by heart, and he's going to speak it on the stage of the Albert Hall. And can you wonder I'm excited? They said it couldn't be done, but it's going to be done. After the show, I'm going to the Albert Hall, and with my very own eyes, I'm going to watch that man Wright utter my air.
You make it very difficult for me. I think Frankmuir wins by very, very narrow margin indeed. And that brings us to a final score in which the margin is about as narrow as it might be, because Dillis Powell and Frankmuir win by one mark from Nancy Spain and Dennis Norden, and that also brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Nancy Spain, Frankmuir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC. ¶¶